Wow, look at you. Congratulations. You made it to episode 15 of Better Place Project with Steve Norris.
Make the world a better place. Make the world a better place. Make the world a better place. Make the world a better place.
Hi, this is Steve, along with my uber wicked smart and sometimes diabolical daughter, Erin. So, Erin, I think it'd be cool to share with our listeners a little more about what you have been doing the last few years. And I know I sound like a proud dad here, but everybody, Erin has graduated. She got her bachelor's from Cal State Fullerton recently. Yep. And Erin, what was your major again?
I majored in child and adolescent studies, and it was a lot of fun. I feel a little bit weird sharing about myself and just getting a little degree, because I know in the grand scheme of things and compared to so many people, that's not, maybe not a huge accomplishment, but for me, it was something that I worked really hard for, and it's really exciting to have that done and under my belt. And I am planning on going back to school. I just haven't confirmed when. And it's just kind of a little weird time for that right now.
To go for your master's, correct?
Yeah, to go for my master's as well as my teaching credential, because I would like to be an elementary school teacher.
And Erin, ever since she was a little girl, all she's ever really wanted to be was a writer. Ever since she was 3, 4, 5 years old, she would write these little short stories all the time. Or school teacher. That's really the main two things you said throughout entire childhood. And here you are. And you have been doing some student teaching over the last year or two, correct?
Yeah, I've gotten to volunteer and do field work at different elementary schools in our area, which has been really cool. It's just, as so many people can relate to, I'm sure, it's just an awkward time for all of that right now. And I know that going back to school at this moment, I would not be getting the same education as I would be if I, you know, had done it earlier before this pandemic. It's just a weird time.
I don't know. I know you were still working really, really hard on it. But what I really feel for people like yourself, whether it's middle school, high school, college, people getting their master's or a PhD that didn't get to have a full graduation ceremony, walking, you know, up and grabbing your certificate, and having your family there. And so post-pandemic, we'll have to do some side little celebration or something, put your cap and gown on and take some photos and all that fun stuff. Because I feel like you missed out, and we all kind of missed out on not having a big graduation ceremony. So yeah. It's a big milestone in your life.
Yeah, I don't know. For me, that part isn't a huge deal. I just kind of wanted to get my stuff done and and finish it all up. But yeah.
Well, you did great, and I'm very proud of you. Good job, Erin.
Thank you. You know what? Maybe someday you'll get your bachelor's degree.
Hey, I barely made it out of high school, so you're putting me on the spot here, Erin. Since you brought that up, I was a freshman year at Illinois State University 10 years ago. Oh, sure. No, many, many moons ago. And I got a phone call from an old buddy, David Wilkerson, to be exact, and asking me to join his rock and roll band. And they were a big band in St. Louis at the time. And so I literally dropped out of school to play rock and roll. And looking back, it was still one of the best decisions I ever made, because I ended up playing in all kinds of cool bands and traveling and going to playing in Norway and Sweden and doing some cool stuff like that. So that was awesome. So no regrets, but all the more reason why I send out big love and shout outs to anybody who finishes what I didn't, and that is getting your college degree. So well done.
Thank you. And it's always nice to learn.
Absolutely. Now that I've always shared a strong curiosity for learning. In fact, I even took some college courses while still in high school on a program that Southern Illinois University had, a program called EduCard. And I'll never forget the professor coming to me at the end of a class one time. And this was like 2 months into the class. And I was really into it. And I took it from 7 a.m. to 8 a.m. before my senior year in high school. And then I would go to high school. And he came up to me and pretty much chastised me and was physically angry with me because he found out that I wasn't a full paid student. I was taking on an EduCard program where you pay like $10 or $15 and you get to take the class, but you don't get any credit. And he was saying, why in the hell would you come here every day like you've been doing and devote so much time for learning and you have nothing to show for it? And I kind of looked at him and I said, because I want to learn and I can't afford the full classes. And it really kind of was a kind of a aha moment to me that wow, aren't we all supposed to be here because we want to learn, not just to get a credit towards a degree? So it kind of actually soured me on formal education. I still think it's awesome, but I think everything that's out there is available for us in books and in travel and all of that good stuff too.
It's so funny how that was a crazy concept for him, that a student in his class just wanted to learn. And that's why you were there.
Absolutely. He thought, why would you? He thought I was wasting my time because I was putting all that time and I wasn't getting college. I kind of get it, that you do want to, if you can, pay for the school and get your college degree. But there was absolutely zero support. Like, hey, way to go, kid. I was like a 17-year-old kid. You think it'd say, hey, good for you. He didn't even know I was a high school kid. He just thought I was a college kid. So anyway, what are you going to do?
That's sad.
But all right, well, let's get to it. In fact, before we get to today's episode, we wanted to give everyone a very quick update on the Paul Rusesabagina story. That's the hero from Hotel Rwanda. We did the podcast a couple weeks ago with Anaïs and Karine, his two daughters. And if you haven't heard it, go back and listen to it. He's been kidnapped and he's on trial. And there's a new development on that trial. This past Wednesday, March 10th, ABC News reported, and other outlets as well, that a special chamber of Rwanda's high court ruled that Rusesabagina was tricked into coming back to Rwanda, but not kidnapped, and the country's laws are silent on arrests under such circumstances. The court ruled that authorities followed the law properly after Rusesabagina arrived in Rwanda. It said the charges against him are serious and can't be jettisoned. So this is just another example of how he's not going to be able to get a fair trial. And his family says that Rusesabagina has no chance at a fair trial because of his outspoken criticism of Kagame and human rights abuses. That's President Kagame. And they also fear he might die from poor health behind bars. Then this past Friday, there were even more developments in the trial in Kigali. After 6 hours in court, the high court judges denied all of the motions filed by Paul Rusesabagina and his attorneys. They then announced that the trial would begin immediately. Paul Rusesabagina made a statement to the court saying, quote, I'd like to tell the court and the judges that my basic rights to defend myself and to have a right to a fair trial were not respected by the court. Therefore, as my rights have been violated, I'd like to tell the court that I don't expect any justice in this court. And so I want to inform you that I will not be appearing again in court for the hearings. I have stopped my trial. Unquote. So just a tragic story that's still going on. For further updates, you can go to hrrfoundation.com. That's hrrfoundation.com. We will keep you all updated on this story in the coming weeks. So, Aaron, tell us a little bit about today's guest.
Eric Maddox is the executive director of Open Roads Media and the founder and producer of Virtual Dinner Guest Project. He completed his undergraduate studies in philosophy and classic literature and his MA in international conflict transformation. After completing his graduate field research in the West Bank, Eric set up the very first virtual dinner guest project in Mexico in 2011. Since that time, Eric has traveled throughout the Middle East, North Africa, South Asia, and Europe to expand the network and the impact of the virtual dinner guest project and to promote what he believes to be the future of news media, collaborative production between local communities on a global scale. He currently resides in Spain, where he continues to produce projects with Open Roads Media as he hosts Latitude Adjustment Podcast that highlights underrepresented communities, places, and issues around the world.
What an impressive guy Eric was, and what an insightful interview about the differences, and more importantly, how much we are all the same, even though we come from different backgrounds and religions and communities. And the thing that really just kind of stuck out with me is when we learned that he bought a one-way ticket to Beirut. Could you imagine being 20-something years old and just hopping on a plane and saying, I'm going to go to Beirut and try to learn about what's going on over there and the culture and the people, and try to connect them with other people that maybe they hate or that they're at war with or have been at war with. Just a really interesting conversation for sure.
Mm-hmm. And I was thinking that our view of the world is primarily shaped by the media, and news reporting by the media is usually really negative. And I feel like so often it focuses on just crime and war, mm-hmm. which is why I really appreciate what he does, the Open Roads Media and Virtual Dinner Guest. And that's how he shared about communities through open dialogue and film, which is really powerful.
Yes, I love what Eric's been doing, not only on those projects, but also with his podcast academy that he's now doing as well, which is not only has he encouraged people from all over the world and young people to put up videos about their lives, whether it be in the Gaza Strip or in, you know, Afghanistan or what have you, but also he's created a podcast academy where they can now go learn how to do their own podcast and create their own narrative and put their own voice out there, which is incredible. And we'll talk about that as well. So let's get right to it. Ladies and gentlemen, our conversation with Eric Maddox. Good morning, Eric. How are we doing?
Good evening from Lesbos. I'm doing fine.
You are in, you know, that was one of the first questions Aaron and I were talking before you hopped on the call, that you are all over the world. So Aaron asked me, so where exactly is Eric now? And I said, well, I think he's in Spain. I think when you and I communicated a few weeks ago, you might have been in Spain at that point.
No, I'm heading to Spain, actually, from here.
Okay. If we could, I want to hear all about what you're doing there in Greece, but I'd really love to start at the very beginning, Eric. Can you tell us, when I first heard about you and read, I think it was on Forbes, about what you've been doing over the last 8-9 years, one of the things that I was interested in when I started going down the rabbit hole and watching some of your videos and going to your website and learning about all your different projects was I was curious to know your background. And it was only yesterday that I discovered that you actually grew up in California. So can you tell us about your upbringing and your childhood?
Oh, wow. You want to go way back.
Yes. Okay.
So we'll have to just kind of, I guess, since we're not co-authoring a Russian novel here, we'll probably need to hit the bullet points.
Perfect. That'll work.
So, yeah, let's see. I did grow up in California, kind of early childhood up until I was 11 in the Napa Valley. So kind of this picturesque, like wine-growing region.
Nice.
For those who are unfamiliar. And then when I was 11, we moved down to Bakersfield, which is kind of the not-so-picturesque, very conservative part of California in the Central Valley that's more famous for oil than anything else. It's very red part of California as well as far as politics.
Yep. Very Republican.
Yeah. So I grew up, really my formative years, like junior high and high school, were spent there. And what can I say about my upbringing other than that I was raised in a Christian evangelical Republican voting household. And I am neither of those things myself now. So it's been a bit of a journey from my origins, which is not to say that I have anything. My parents were great people. And I learned a lot of the values that I carry with me now from my upbringing. But sure. I am an atheist with pretty strong leftist inclinations at this point.
So what kind of series of events then throughout your childhood and into high school and college, and I know you studied philosophy mm-hmm. and all, where was it that you kind of fell into doing what you have been doing, and let's say starting with the virtual dinner guest project?
Okay, so that requires a bit more backstory as well. So I would say that my initial interest in international relations, diplomacy, and what's become more of an interest in human rights. Let's see. I would say that that traces more back to, part of it is a function, I think, of just the morality that I was raised with. You know, I think that I was raised right, so to speak, in a lot of ways, and to, you know, consider other people's needs and not just my own. But also, I was very fortunate to be able to accompany an uncle and aunt to Zimbabwe when I was 14 years old. My aunt didn't have any kids. This is my dad's sister. And so from when I was a little kid, she told me, look, every birthday and every Christmas, you're not going to get a present from me, really, but you're going to get a little bit of savings and an account. And someday we're going to take a trip.
Wow.
That was supposed to be, I think, after I graduated from high school, but then an opportunity just presented itself right before I started high school. My uncle had been born in what was then, I believe, the colony of Rhodesia to American missionary parents, and he hadn't been back in like 50 years. And his brother had become one of the chief wildlife conservation people in the Zimbabwean cabinet, and I think one of the few white members of the cabinet after independence. He spoke fluent Shona. He spent his whole life there. And so we had a chance to go to Zimbabwe and travel all over the country. And it was really my first time being outside the U.S., except for like, you know, a short trip to Mexico when I was a little kid in Canada. Wow. So that mm-hmm. kind of blew my mind open. I mean, I saw a lot of things aside from the wild animals and like the stereotypical things that you might expect or want to see on a trip to Africa and rural parts of Africa. I saw poverty. I saw people going without in a variety of ways, from basic medical needs to being hungry, in ways that, you know, I'd never even come close to encountering in the U.S. I've seen poverty all over the world, but really in most places I've been, I've never seen anything quite like what I saw in Zimbabwe. Just utter desperation. Wow. In some context. So that is to say that made an imprint on me. And I came back, went to high school, you know, did what I did for 4 years as any high school student, and then wound up studying classic literature and philosophy as an undergrad. I went to university, a small liberal arts school in New Mexico called St. John's. And I didn't really travel at any point in those intervening years. But what did happen that kind of informed that I knew that I wanted to travel again. Like that trip had a massive impact on me, but as like a young man, I didn't have the means to travel. I never did like the backpacking thing in Europe, anything like that. But I knew I wanted to get out into the world and kind of on my own. And a number of things kind of converged to, you know, guide my path, like where I chose to go. One was that as a Christian, I was interested in the Middle East from a biblical standpoint. That's really what informed my initial interest in that part of the world. And also as a young man, I was interested in the romantic allure of like dangerous, so to speak, dangerous places and mysterious places. I had very kind of orientalist, frankly, in retrospect, racist and colonialist views about North Africa and West Asia. But that was what sparked my initial interest in that part of the world. And I didn't particularly want to travel in quote-unquote developed countries either. I wanted to see unusual places. And so what also happened 3 months after I graduated from college were the terrorist attacks on September 11th, 2001. I graduated right before that happened. And
wow.
I remember just asking myself, well, okay, this is like I think every American did. Like the world is not going to be the same tomorrow. or for the foreseeable future. It's not clear what it's going to look like, but it's going to be different. And what's my place in that? How is that going to impact, you know, my decisions going forward? And after wrestling with a number of different ideas, I decided that I wanted to go to the Middle East to study Arabic and to try and get some better understanding of what informed perceptions in that part of the world toward the U.S. And again, I mean, that's like that's the safe version of the story. But to be honest, I was also attracted to, again, the allure of what I thought was a dangerous part of the world where like scary people with backwards notions were amassed. And I wanted to kind of prove to myself that I was brave. And based on just stereotypes that I just digested from mainstream media, Hollywood, et cetera.
Sure, yeah.
So I wasn't going there with particularly enlightened perspective on the Middle East. And when I wound up there, I spent a semester in Egypt studying in an intensive Arabic institute, traveled all over Egypt, and then also wound up traveling all over Lebanon. And in the course of doing that, I met Arabs, obviously. And although most of my conversations were in English, because my Arabic's never been great and certainly wasn't then, I started to encounter people who could not only answer my best questions, but were asking me questions that I couldn't answer about my country, and especially its role in their countries. And I started to also realize that this was back for people who followed the Arab Spring and know just the basic recent history of Egypt. Hosni Mubarak was the longtime dictator of that country who was deposed in February of 2011, and what was kind of like the beginning, one of the beginning moments of the Arab Spring. I was there in 2002 when he was still very much firmly in power, and there were like big posters of him all over the place and armed soldiers like every few paces all over downtown Cairo. And it just seemed like this guy's not going anywhere ever. And that was kind of the general consensus view at the time too, is it just like this regime is too strong, it's got American support. And that last part is the part that I didn't know about and that really started to change my views. And I started to realize, wait a minute, like the U.S. has given how much money to this corrupt dictatorship that oppresses its own people? Like, I realized that Egypt was the second largest recipient of U.S. foreign aid money, and that it dumped like 90% of that into its military, even though it really didn't have any adversaries. So what was it using that military to do internally was the question I started to ask. And then that just led to more questions about, you know, what is the U.S.'s role in the world? And I had kind of this right of center, naive, an unquestioned view of geopolitics. And so I came back to the U.S. in, late 2002. And also while I was there, this is when like all the idea of invading Iraq was like all over the place. We weren't sure if it was going to happen while I was there. And I was concerned about like, how would I be perceived as an American? And a part of the world where my country might be launching an invasion soon. So I came back to the U.S. Right before that happened, right before the invasion of Iraq in 2003, and watched that happen and started reading and reading and reading and trying to understand what informed my country's obsession with that part of the world, aside from the obvious things like oil. Why we seem to be so consistently on the wrong side of the very principles that we claim to champion when it comes to individual liberties, human rights, all of those things. It seemed like we were just always on the wrong side. Why was that? And I started reading a lot of books, and ultimately that led to me going to graduate school and studying international conflict transformation. And during that time, this is now 2006, 2007, I met a Palestinian guy, and I spent a year on campus. This school is back in Vermont. And he said, look, if you want to do your field research phase in Palestine, you're welcome to come and stay in my refugee camp. You just need to get yourself there. And I had very different views of specifically the situation between Israel and Palestine at that time. A lot of it informed by my Christian evangelical upbringing. And I jumped at the chance. I mean, I was already kind of coming around to questioning the kind of the dominant American narrative, which is historically fairly unquestioningly pro-Israel, especially the U.S. political narrative. And so I went, and I spent 5 months, most of that living in the Haitian refugee camp in the West Bank. It's in Bethlehem. That's the Bethlehem, of course. And traveled all over the West Bank and all over Israel for many months, interviewing Palestinians and Israelis who had personally gone through the 1948 war on the 60th anniversary of that war. And that is the war that for Israelis became their independence war. It's when the British left and when they fought five different armies off to lay claim to the territory that later expanded. And it's what Palestinians refer to as the Nakba, or in Arabic means the catastrophe, which was the first massive wave of Palestinian refugees who fled their homes, fleeing that war, and many of whom still have the titles to their houses and the keys to their houses and have not yet been allowed to return now more than 70 years later. So that was eye-opening for me in a lot of ways. We don't have time to really go into all of the details of what I saw and how it changed me. Because that also would, for obvious reasons, require me anticipating and addressing a lot of political controversies around that topic, but it changed me.
Sure. Just
suffice it to say that the things that I saw did not match, once again, the narrative I was receiving in dominant Western media, the political rhetoric coming out of my own country and other Western countries. And I felt like, again, like I had in Egypt, I felt like I'd been had. I felt, and it's kind of a feeling that has inspired a lot of my work is, I mean, there's an optimism in what I do. I have a fundamental faith in humanity's likelihood to do the right thing when presented with the right information, you know? But I also have a lot of frustration with my government and other governments when it comes to not living up to their principles and our principles as citizens of those countries. And also, I was just shocked that, wait a minute, I come from a country where we have a free press. I mean, how could we possibly be deceived? Because there's dissent is welcomed, you know, or at least possible. This isn't North Korea. How is it that I've been deceived for so much of my life? And it's when I really started to realize just how much, you know, there was a lopsided narrative in much of what we consume in English language press. And there are reasons for that, that, you know, that it can be simple to describe, but then have a complicated backstory. But when I started to realize that, that was what began to inform my shift towards realizing, look, I want to use media, independent media production, as a tool for conflict resolution. And to wrap up like this backstory, what I wound up doing in the West Bank in Israel, I was living in the West Bank, but traveling back and forth a lot. I picked up a camera. I borrowed a camera from a place where I had an internship, and I just started filming the interviews that I was conducting with people. I interviewed the principal participants on both sides. So that meant a lot of Palestinian refugees and former commandos on the Israeli side, and then their grandchildren, to see how those stories had been passed down through multiple generations. And I'd never picked up a camera in my life, had no idea what I was doing. But I took that footage back to the U.S. and taught myself how to edit by enrolling in a community college. Actually, after I had graduated from graduate school, I started pursuing another degree, kind of, like just so that I would have access to the classrooms and the resources. And in doing that, I cut this very kind of basic documentary film, entered that into a competition for the New Mexico State Film Office, where I was living at the time.
Yeah, I read about that, and you got a grant. Yeah, I got a grant. Out of it, huh?
So I started working on the U.S.-Mexico really cool. border, and I just did a mirror project. I just did essentially the same thing.
I believe that was a couple years you spent down there.
Yeah,
Eric.
I spent about a year and a half. This is now, I think, between 2009 2011, traveling back and forth across the U.S.-Mexico border, and documenting, you know, reality and perceptions on both sides of the. It's really the wall. There already was one when I was there, a fairly sizable one that had been voted on by Obama, Biden, and Hillary Clinton in 2006 under what was called the Secure Fences Act. And from there, the idea to get to the Virtual Dinner Guest Project was after shooting about 100 hours of footage and running out of money and realizing I was in way over my head, trying to figure out, okay, what can I do with all the connections that I've made and the experiences that I've had? That footage is still sitting in a box. I want to do something with it at some point still. Sadly, a lot of it is still completely irrelevant all these years later. But
seriously,
but yeah. What I decided to do with realizing I didn't have much money was, what if I just connected people on both sides of the border to have a conversation? And then how do I do that in a way that will be disarming, that will allow people to see each other as equals and won't feel kind of cold and like a business call? And that's where the idea of food came from. So that's the Virtual Dinner Guest Project was born in July of 2011 after I spent several months down in Juarez, or not several months in Juarez, but several months going back and forth between New Mexico and Mexico, Juarez, Mexico, setting up Skype accounts and web cameras in Mexican families' houses and setting up what was to become the first Virtual Dinner Guest Project, this cross-border conversation between Mexicans in what was then the murder capital of the world because of all the narco violence, and Americans on the other side of the border in New Mexico. And from there, this was 2011, so the Arab Spring was happening. And so you can imagine what I was thinking. Like, I've already been in the Middle East twice. Things seem to be changing. I need to get back over there. But I was a social worker.
Yeah, it was an exciting time.
Yeah, very exciting.
For sure.
So I was a social worker, you know, it was my day job, and had been in various places for years. And so I thought, well, I mean, it was just to say I didn't have a budget. You know, I wasn't independently wealthy. So in the end of 2011, I just made a Facebook post. I had done like a few practice versions of this virtual dinner guest idea between a few countries in the U.S. And I just said, look, I'm gonna buy a one-way ticket to Beirut and try and get myself to the Middle East and then launch this idea, because I think that citizens should be the diplomats in a moment where our countries are failing in that regard. We need to be out front of our so-called leadership, and if nothing else, just kind of shame them by showing that, look, dialogue is possible with no money and just everyday citizens having a willingness to engage in it. And so the reason I chose Beirut, one of the countries that at the time was not actually going through an uprising, was because that's where the Syrians were headed to, fleeing their war in their country. And so February 2012, so I mean, it's February now, so what, 9 years ago? That's crazy. I wound up on a plane to Lebanon, and I thought I would be gone for maybe 4 months, and that turned into 4 years of nonstop travel and setting up about, ultimately, what became about 80 of these encounters, these cross-cultural encounters between different countries, but a lot of them in the Middle East. So,
and if I could stop you right there, just I just want to impress upon you how that just kind of grabbed me when I first saw the first video and read the first article on that, Eric. Aaron will tell you, I'm a foodie. I love having family together around a table and friends and relatives, and I consider myself pretty well traveled, or I did until I met you, and I realized I'm not very well traveled at all. But yeah, I've been all over Europe and Central South America and whatnot. But to me, you know, we've all had situations in our lives where, whether it be a distant cousin or whether it be a client that you don't get a good vibe from and you don't particularly think you're going to gel with that person, or you have these misconceptions about them of who they are, and then you end up at a gathering and you sit down, you know, next to them or across from them at a table. And when you are breaking bread with someone, when you are just talking about life, and you know, we quickly, all those barriers, all those preconceived notions, those prejudices just fade away instantly, and it is virtually impossible, I have found, to even come close to disliking someone, let alone hating them, after you've shared a meal with them. So can you tell us a little bit about some transformations, or we've seen it in some of the videos, but for our listeners, can you tell us, that must have been really rewarding after some of these dinners to talk with some of these people and get their feedback on what they learned?
Yes. So the question is, what were the key moments?
Yeah, was there, can you just, yeah, a couple of incidents where, whether it be people from Lebanon or what have you, that they learned about somebody from another country, what was different than their preconceived notion? Sure.
So I think one thing that will be helpful to do is also to just describe like how the project actually works, like what it is. Because they're, well, on the surface and the name itself, it correctly implies that people are eating together. It's important for me that people understand that it's not just the eating that's significant. It's the fact that we are coming together with intention, and that people exchange news articles from their respective countries about each other's countries before they come and sit and eat together so that they have something to discuss. I learned to do this by trial and error. And initially I thought, you know, food is great and that should be enough. And I agree with you. And I think that there's a lot of truth in the fact that, you know, food really does like help to disarm people and humanize them. That's why I kept it a part of the project after the first few iterations of it. I think it works. I think it has a profound psychological effect on people for the positive. But I also realized that there need to be other elements in here to make this sustainable and to make it visible to the public, for one. If you're just trying to change the world by having like 10 people eat together at a time, you're going to either take 1,000 years or you're going to need a massive, massive budget in your own news network. So,
sure.
So the idea was to figure out how do we get this message out to other people? And some of that took the form of what I'm assuming are the videos that you're referring to. So
Where they take to the streets and talk to people and ask them the questions.
So the idea is to take these, what could be like these insular, though compelling conversations, and then take the participants and turn them into filmmakers. And that was an idea that came maybe a year and a half or more into doing it. Because I just realized, look, like people are doing this, but they're starting to comment. And I'm starting to realize too that this isn't really doing anything other than creating maybe some media buzz. Not a lot of people are seeing what we're talking about. And so what can we do to make this more meaningful and engaging for the public? So the idea then became to have people sit down, have these conversations where we can talk about light topics for sure, but it takes a lot of work to set these things up. So part of my role is the moderator, and I've moderated all of these discussions. Is to have a light hand. Like, I'm not trying to tell people what to think or what to say or not to say, but just to make sure that we have substantive conversations, that everybody gets a chance to speak, and that we take turns. That's about it. And then at the end of these discussions that last about 90 minutes over a shared meal over an internet connection, and there's about 5 people on each side at a dinner table that has a screen on the end of it that looks like it's continuing into the other people's living room or classroom or country. We exchange a final question, and whatever question you receive from the other country, you then have to turn into a documentary film. You have about 2 weeks to make it. And that experience, coupled with the initial experience of sitting down and sharing a meal with people, like all of that stuff kind of comes together to, I think, have this transformational impact. And I can't speak for everybody who's ever been through the project. I can just speak for what I've experienced as someone who's been through it many, many times and what I've witnessed in many occasions. And what I've noticed is that it's, yes, there is the disarming effect of food, but there's also the relationship building effect of creative collaboration. And that was like kind of the magic element, I think, that was missing before with just having people talk. It was, okay, if you tell people in India to go to the streets and make a film to answer a Pakistani question, and the Pakistanis are doing the same thing with an Indian question in the streets of Islamabad, they might not actually be making the film together physically, like they're not in the same location, but they have a shared ordeal. They have a shared commitment and a shared sense of responsibility to answer each other's questions faithfully. You know, if you want an honest answer, you need to make sure you get one too. And it's also not easy. And I think that that's important. Like, we're not just asking them to, you know, answer a couple of questions on a sheet of paper. We task them with saying, look, you need to not just hang out on your university campus or pick one location to hang out at for a couple of minutes and ask some questions. You need to challenge yourself in your own national context, in your own cultural context, to go to the places that make you uncomfortable. And I mean that physically, like geographically, moving around your city to the different parts of your town or country, in the case of Lebanon, where we went all over the place. But also, you know, approaching people that you might have judgments about, that you suspect might not share your life experience or your perspective. And a huge part of the Virtual Dinner Guest Project and the filmmaking component of that has been not really just about these exchanges that are international, you know, and that I think for a lot of people, they think that's the compelling part, is this international connection. Mm-hmm. But really for me, I've learned that if you want to have a meaningful intercultural dialogue, you need to make sure that the people on either side are also adequately representing their communities, and that they are also making an effort to understand their own communities. So the filmmaking serves that function. It extends the experience of the conversation to people who aren't at the events or who might not have the means to participate in a project like this, either because they don't speak English or for other reasons. So it extends the scope of the conversation. You get out in the street and challenge people to talk to people that they might not have for dinner at their house in their own country, right? And also you expose an international audience to what the answers are, because we take these short films and we post them online for an international audience. But that is what it is, and I love it, and we're trying to continue doing it. But I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the fact that for the last couple of years, we've been focusing more of our energy on a podcast, which is aimed at accomplishing some of the same things. And that's actually why I'm in Lesvos right now, is to teach people how to make podcasts.
And that's for Latitude Adjustment.
Yes, that's for the Latitude Adjustment podcast.
Which, by the way, we communicated last week that you had pointed out that you also did an episode on the Clotilda in Africa Town in Alabama, which was amazing. That was really cool for me because we talked to two different ancestors of the enslaved Africans that came over, as well as the captain of the actual Clotilda ship. Mm-hmm. So for those listeners out there that aren't sure what we're talking about, we did an episode on the Clotilda, a two-part, and Eric out on his podcast is Latitude Adjustment, and I really enjoyed that conversation, by the way, Eric, on that topic. So you guys did a great job, and I learned a lot about something that Aaron and I have spent hours and hours and hours on, so it was really, really cool. And we want to, at some point, go travel to Alabama and...
Same. Yeah, I want to go to Africa Town for sure.
Yeah, for sure. So, well, maybe we'll all coordinate and be there at the same time. That would be amazing.
Yeah, that'd be great.
So,
yeah, that'd be great.
But before we move on and talk about the podcast, one of the things I just wanted to touch upon that struck me as I went through all these videos online and of seeing people of all ages in, whether it be India or Pakistan or the Gaza Strip or the Netherlands or what have you, is a just recurring kind of theme that I heard was that we all want the same thing. We all want a job, security for our family, peace. I can't tell you how many times you hear peace coming from these everyday citizens. And there was one line from a young gentleman, and I think it was he was in the Gaza Strip, and I believe that was a program with the Netherlands. Mm. But he had mentioned something along the lines of that he was struck when he was asked the question, what are your dreams? And he said, you know, I'm taken aback by that because all of our dreams are just to have rights. And that just kind of slayed me, that comment, because like you, I grew up in a world that we dream about being a baseball player or a scientist or an astronaut or what have you. And you know, they're just asking for basic human rights, peace, food, and a job, and a decent life. So I don't know what my question is there, but just thank you for helping to bridge the gap between, you know, different nations and different cultures. I just think it's a beautiful thing that you've done, Eric.
First, what you've seen is bigger than me, and it's required volunteers to support it, like facilitators on the ground in Gaza, where they've got, and obviously other places too, but where they have all kinds of daily challenges. And so it's not, I mean, all of those projects have been a collaborative effort, and I have to acknowledge that. And I think that it's, I'm glad that you made the point that you did in highlighting, like, you know, for some people, their dreams like are kind of on hold because they don't have access to basic needs and rights. And I think that it's, I'm kind of one of the more cynical people about quote unquote peace projects as someone who runs one, right? And part of it is because I've seen like what I was doing in my own naivete and what I would, things that I did that weren't helpful. I've seen how there's kind of an industry around marketing, like intercultural contact type initiatives that I think sometimes are more about just the optics than they are about really accomplishing any meaningful change. They don't really disrupt anything. They shy away from controversy or allowing people to say the things that are uncomfortable for us to hear. And one thought that occurs to me too is when we're talking about peace, I don't remember who said it. I think probably quite a few people have said it. Martin Luther King may have said it himself, but we need to remember that peace is not just the absence of violence. It requires the presence of justice. And if you are enforcing a peace on a people that is just putting the lid on all of their suffering, that in itself is an act of violence. It is a denial of their fundamental human rights. And from what I studied, you know, as a graduate student in conflict resolution and conflict theory classes, when people are deprived of their basic needs, it's not a question of if they will become violent. It's inevitable.
Question.
It's inevitable.
When, yeah.
And part of that is because what they are in fact responding to is a form of violence. It's just not as visible to us. And that's also in a sense what all of this is about for me, whether it's podcasting or filmmaking, and that is to make things more visible, to make sure that people are being heard, but not to take a paternalistic view either. Another expression that kind of drives me crazy is this, that you hear a lot, is like giving voice to the voiceless. I've been interacting with people that are coming from, you know, oppressed and marginalized backgrounds for many years, and they've all had voices. You just need to pass the microphone and make sure that they get heard. And there's a paternalistic notion, I think, involved in saying like, well, let me be the one. So I try, well, my show features me and my voice, and I'm interviewing people just like you are. I'm sure just like you are, you know, you're trying to make sure that like the ideas get highlighted and that you get as close to the source as possible when trying to understand the root causes of conflict or people's general frustrations.
Very well said. Yeah, I'm speechless, and I unfortunately share the cynicism that that you do. Mm-hmm. That when we talk about peace and some of the peace projects that are out there, and also some of the cynicism about my own country, mm-hmm. especially the last 4 years with the previous administration, and Aaron and I are adamant that we did not want this podcast to be a political podcast. Mm. But I think in order for, at the same time though, we can't be naive. And if we truly do want to be one little cog in the wheel of trying to make the world a better place and shining the light on people like yourself that are truly trying to do game-changing things, then we have to have these difficult conversations.
Yeah.
And so moving forward, let's talk about latitude adjustment and what you're doing. And also, I understand that you are also, in fact, is latitude adjustment the program where you are also teaching refugees how to launch their own podcasts and get their own voices out there?
Yeah. Thank you for asking the question to clarify any possible confusion, because there are two things. So Latitude Adjustment is a podcast co-hosted by myself and Leila Mochaber, my co-host who's based in the U.S. in the Washington, D.C. area. I started the podcast back in, I believe it was August of 2018, and we've produced like, I don't know, like 70-something episodes at this point. But more recently, and I should say that the purpose of that podcast is to highlight underreported places, communities, and issues around the world. So as you can imagine, a heavy focus on human rights, and marginalized communities. Interviewed a lot of refugees, but guests have ranged all over the place. From we did a recent episode with someone in the anti-police brutality protests in Nigeria, to Mexico, all over the place. And a heavy focus in the Middle East. So that's the focus of the podcast. Yeah.
Speaking of Nigeria as well, Aaron and I did a podcast with a Dr. Clinton Kanu a couple months back who was falsely imprisoned and spent 27 years in prison for a crime he did not commit, including 14 years on death row. And now he's out and trying to work on prison reform. And he estimates that 85% of the prisoners on death row are completely innocent. And it's just a corrupt society where judges are paid off, all lawyers are paid off, and somebody wants to get rid of a political opponent or even a business opponent, they file a false charge. And before you know it, that person's in jail for possibly the rest of their life and possibly even executed.
Yeah. I mean, there were horrific. Some similar points were made by our guest as well. That a huge percentage of the people who are imprisoned are most likely just innocent and they're on trumped up charges. And then, I mean, that's its own topic that I don't want to short shrift. Yep. But yeah, I mean, there's police brutality is not unique to the U.S. For sure. Yep. But that's a recent episode, too, people could check out. If they wanted to listen to our podcast, we've covered topics all over the place. And then the Podcast Academy is a recent idea that we just launched for the first time here. And I'm on the Greek island of Lesbos, which is just within sight of the Turkish coastline. So I'm on the borders of the European Union here. And it's the site of where many, many boats, I think hundreds of thousands of people passed through here in 2015. And what got a ton of media attention and was characterized as the European refugee crisis. I was here in 2015. When that was happening, I came back again last year to produce my own shows, going to Moria Camp, which was then the largest refugee camp in Europe, and then decided more recently, why don't we just take, it seems like the natural extension of this idea of putting the microphone on other people and having other people tell their stories is to just teach them how to do it themselves. And part of what inspired that was that Moria Camp, which while I was here, it was about almost exactly this time last year. It's a former military facility that was expanded to accommodate about 3,000 people. And at the time that I was here, there were about 22,000 people. It was just exploding with overcrowded. And this is right before COVID happened. So you can just imagine the conditions people were living in and the idea of social isolation when you basically don't even barely have running water and everybody's living in like tents. If they're lucky, some people are living in just shacks that they made out of pallets they find on the ground and they chop down the olive trees to burn at night so they could stay warm. It was just a complete horror show. So that was the context this time last year. And then in September, the camp burned down. Over the course of two nights, which suggested it probably wasn't, an accident. It's not clear from what I understand about who did that, and I don't need to get into that here, but it happened. People wound up sleeping in the streets, thousands of people. And then very quickly, the Greek government, I don't know all the details, but I assume with some European Union support, erected a new camp. And so that's what it's been like for the last few months since September. You have about 7,000 people locked inside of what is also a former military facility, but this was a former artillery and shooting range. So there's serious concerns about lead contamination in the ground where you've got children running around and playing in the dirt. That just one issue to highlight of many. Barely enough showers. Mm-hmm. I mean, not barely enough. There are not enough showers, barely any showers for people who've been stuck in there for months. They're right on the coastline. And it gets cold here. This is not Hawaii. It's an island, but it gets cold. It snowed here when I was here in 2015. They can leave the camp because one thing to understand is that I want your listeners to understand that it doesn't just apply to Greece. It probably applies in a lot of different places around the world, that the virus has been used as a pretext for kind of hiding vulnerable populations from view. And so under the pretext of, you know, needing to quarantine people, which there's some truth in it, of course, they've been locked inside this camp, just as they were in Moria camp for the duration of the virus when that camp was open. And because it's on military property, there's also the pretext of saying, look, nobody can come here and document it because it's sensitive military installation. I mean, I just spent my afternoon looking at it. I didn't see anything that looked particularly sensitive to me there. It's a disused shooting range. But what you could do a year ago was you could walk into Moria camp. I walked around filming all over it, right? Mm-hmm. You can't do that now. So, and the NGOs that are allowed in are told that there's an effective gag order where they are told you are not allowed to even tell people what you are seeing or hearing here. It's chilling.
Oh my! So, if I'm hearing you right, Eric, they've got two convenient excuses between COVID and it being a military facility that they basically were able to oppress the people and let nothing get out.
Yeah. So the idea was. This is part of, like, the idea for the Podcast Academy really sprang from, like, in some ways a solution to that problem. How do you get the word out, right?
Yeah.
And then it just kind of dawned on me and Layla, like, well, what if we just made the people in the camp podcasters and figured out a way to, like, train
beautiful.
Them so that they could just tell their own stories? Because you can make a podcast if you want to, you know, just using your phone. You can make them pretty simply. So there was a partnering organization that I'd worked with this time last year called Refocus Media Labs. They've been here for about 3 years, and they're already doing something similar where they're training refugees in videography and photography skills, and they've been putting out a ton of content, especially during COVID when they're basically like citizen journalists in the refugee camp were the only people who could document it when Moria was under lockdown. And
sure.
So
interesting.
They're an amazing partner, and I just want to make sure that they get some notice too. But we took on their students for this initial podcast academy. And so what ended up happening was over the course of 5 weeks, about half of our class was stuck inside the camp, and they're all asylum seekers here. And the other half were people who had transitioned out of the camp but were still on Lesbos. And we had to connect over Zoom calls and share media files and do editing remotely. And by the way, while all this is going on, under like the restrictive military installation measures and lack of access and COVID restrictions and noisy tents that people are living in next to the sea and in the cold and lack of access to great internet connections and electricity in some cases, about 70% of the class didn't speak English. And I don't speak any Farsi. So we had to improvise and have the students simultaneously translate everything that I was saying for 5 weeks over Zoom calls where we couldn't even afford like the executive account. Like we had to like keep logging back in every 40 minutes.
Every 40 minutes.
So and we managed to get it done, and we produced 3 episodes with our 9 graduating students and working on another one here before I leave with another student. And that's what we're fundraising for now. We're trying to get people to support our efforts to continue to train displaced people to be podcasters. That's our focus.
I love that idea. You're basically putting out megaphones all over the area and giving, you talked about voices earlier in the podcast and passing a microphone. This is exactly what this is accomplishing.
That's the idea. That's the hope. Yeah.
And can you talk, Eric, a little bit about, you had mentioned in one of your interviews that you've literally been in a country with armed guards that all of a sudden basically, and you're walking around with a camera, that tell you, turn off that camera, essentially, you know, put you in your car and tell you to get the heck out of there, and you have to leave and you can't tell that story. And obviously, that's one form of censorship. And then what you just talked about in the refugee camp with not allowing cameras and you know, how obviously the podcast is one area, but how has that impacted your ability to get these stories out there? Just censorship in countries all over the world.
Remind me what you're referring to in the first example. if there's...
Yeah, you had mentioned in an interview that I read somewhere that censorship sometimes had become a barrier from you getting mm-hmm. your mm-hmm. story.
True.
Where you'd be in a country telling a story, walking around with cameras, and all of a sudden the you weren't welcome there. And,
yeah.
And not only that, this was an interesting point. Not only that, you felt like you being an American, that you weren't necessarily putting your own life in danger,
okay. yeah.
but by
yeah.
interviewing some of these local people, you were putting them yeah. and their families like in danger.
That sounds like Egypt and some other places.
I believe it was Egypt. Yeah, yeah, yeah. yeah.
Because I didn't, I mean, when you mentioned a car, I'm like, I haven't had a car in a while. So anybody forcing me to get into a car sounds like that's been some time since that scenario could unfold. But as far as, I mean, I take your general point, and that is that, I mean, I haven't had anybody wave a gun in my face, threatening me. Not exactly. I've been through some checkpoints that were, I'm a little bit hair raising, but really on the whole, I've been very fortunate, with my safety. But the point is, as you mentioned, that there is a responsibility that comes from like the privilege you have as a Westerner or American passport carrier, where I might be able to run around to some degree, even run my mouth off in certain contexts where the local population can't. And if they're involved in, you know, supporting a project or involved in producing it, you know, at the end of the day, I might escape with, like, you know, at worst getting slapped around a little bit and then deported. But they might face one of those kinds of awful prison sentences you were talking about, you know, where they get thrown away for 20 years or worse. And in Egypt, after the coup happened in 2013, there's some things I still honestly need to be a little bit quiet about, that I might be more open about at a later date. But I found myself being subject of politically motivated personal attacks, not physical threats, but attempts to destroy my reputation.
And discredit you, yeah.
I was also working with people who, you know, worse could happen to them. And so there is this tension between, you know, right at a time when governments are cracking down and trying to control the narrative, that's when you should be pushing back hardest. You know, that's why, that's the highest calling for a journalist, you know, is to speak truth to power. But at the same time, if it's not just your butt on the line, you need to be aware of that fact too. And that you have a responsibility to the people who are more vulnerable around you. And so we effectively had to stop doing any projects in Egypt around that time. I think we might have done one more in 2016, but it was like people were very uncomfortable and we had to be extremely careful. And I just realized, mm-hmm. look, you reaches a point where you're being so careful that it's actually starts to be difficult to be authentic. You know, can you do street interviews anymore? If you can't, then maybe it's better to just find a place where you can. So censorship... I've had to fight back against it also, even in cases where it's been organizations supporting me, saying they want me to remove certain voices. You know, there's one too angry Palestinian in here.
Interesting.
And to me, the person didn't even sound angry. It just sounded like they were telling the truth, right? But and they were in a difficult situation. So that's I think, where, you know, my cynicism, I think, is rooted in how some people respond to those circumstances, because I think there are quote unquote peace initiatives out there that, like, they just play it safe. They don't want to hurt like their revenue stream, or their funders tell them, look, we also receive funding in order to fund you. So if you run around there speaking too much truth, you know, they're never going to say it that way. But if you run around there like shaking the boat too much, that your meal ticket's on the line. And once mm-hmm. organizations start to grow to a certain degree to where now you've got a staff and those staff have families that they need to feed, then you just start kind of looking at it as, I think in some cases, people just start looking at these things as like a cash cow, you know, like we just have a formula we can plug in. We just kind of recycle the same narratives over and over again. We have a photo op at the end where some people who are supposed to be in warring camps, like, hug each other and everybody gets to feel good about each other, including our funders. And we don't say anything dangerous about, you know, maybe who the responsible parties are or where money, taxpayer dollars are getting spent, or how Americans, you know, how what is being said in our name overseas? That's a question I want to just pose to Americans every day. You know, are you aware of how you're being represented abroad by how your tax dollars are being spent overseas? And could they be spent better somewhere else, you know, or not at all?
And on that topic, I know we've just got a couple minutes left, Eric. What further advice can you give our listeners, not only Americans, but people in Europe, South America, all over the world, where they can get truth? But I think especially here in America, you are right. Once I travel to Europe and South America, and just hearing the perception of people is so different than what we see of ourselves. So what advice can you give to our listeners to learn more about not only what you're doing, but to learn more about other cultures and learn the truth about other cultures around the world?
I think there's I'll just try best I can just kind of come up with a short list of ideas. Number one thing, if you can, and not everybody can, travel, get to these places. And don't look at travel always as like just a vacation opportunity, you know. Look at it as an opportunity to learn. And that doesn't have to just be work, you know. I mean, learning is its own reward, I think. It's fascinating to learn about new cultures and how their perspectives on the world can be radically different. So there's that. And as you said, the ways in which we all do have similar needs and dreams too. That's true. I don't like to overemphasize the differences, but I also think that they are important to note. Like, we shouldn't just say everybody's the same, because we aren't. We have different ideologies and we have different backgrounds and different like prospects for success in our life based on the places that we're born. So that's important to acknowledge too. But so travel is a big one. And if you can't, and you want to understand the experience of refugees, or if you don't know too many Muslims or people from a different, you know, faith background, or from any faith background, there's a pretty good chance you have an Islamic center in like the next big city. You know, there's a pretty good chance that like in a country as diverse as the United States, that refugees have been resettled in your town or one next to it. Go find them. You know, you don't have to travel to the other side of the planet to understand or to get firsthand testimonies of people that have endured armed conflict, that have had to endure, you know, the spear end of American diplomacy or foreign policy, or that just can help you to better understand realities that are unimaginably distant from our own. So that's key also. Don't take other people's word for someone else's reality by just absorbing it through the news and just assuming, well, that sounds good. No, go talk to the people. You know, if you want to understand what Mexican undocumented people in the U.S. of different backgrounds, or Mexican nationals living and working in the U.S. think about how their country is being characterized in the press, talk to them. They're probably already in your community. That's a big one. Another, as far as our news consumption habits, don't get everything from one source. You know, and that, I mean, that goes for the far left of the spectrum too. There's plenty of nonsense propaganda coming from the end of the spectrum I identify with, you know, and it does nobody any favors when you share that stuff, because it just ends up presenting a caricature of your own interests too. And it harms your own credibility. So just because you agree with something, or just because something is lampooning or mocking a perspective that you also think deserves mockery, that if it's doing it in a dishonest way, don't share it. You know, stick to the truth. The truth, if it's on your side, is your strongest asset. And be vigilant about it. We need to police our own camps a little bit better and make sure that like we aren't just looking to mock our enemies, but that we're holding our own allies to account, and that we have a code of integrity, you know, that informs how we share information. Whether it's information we agree with or not. So that's another key one. And truth is, that's like a whole philosophical like sidetrack, right? Like what we want to get into, what form of truth. But I think that where you start to see where you're being deceived is, or to see the areas in which you're starting to be manipulated and deceived by the political rhetoric or media, dominant media culture in any country, that skill has to be earned. You know, it's not just that you pick the right source or the right journalist to follow. You need to read enough to where you start to see where the consistencies and the inconsistencies are and how stories get told and what gets left out, what gets left to like the fifth paragraph, even though it should probably be the lead paragraph. You know, why do certain facts always seem to get buried? So you have to make it like more than just a passing interest. I think that Americans also need to become scholars of their own history. And we're a country that has, I think as Gore Vidal once said, like he called us the United States of amnesia. Like we keep repeating a lot of this stuff because we don't pay attention to where we come from and where we've already been. And the people who say that, you know, well, we need to just let bygones be bygones. It's you can also be a prisoner to your own history. It's not a question of just it being your decision to want to move forward. If you haven't actually reconciled yourself to the sins and mistakes of the past, and if those things continue to exist in the form of unjust laws and systemic injustice, then there needs to be a reckoning with our past. We need to understand how we got here if we want to actually have, you know, a more more just and equitable future.
Eric, this has been a fascinating conversation. I could talk to you for hours on end for sure, but I think on that note, I cannot think of a better place to pause this conversation for now. Thank you so much for coming on. And before we let you go, openroadsmedia.org, I'm assuming is a good place to start.
Yeah, do you mind if I just throw out some websites? And
please
cast,
throw out all your plugs.
I'm happy to plug myself, if that's okay.
That's awesome. Please cool. do.
So yes, I would direct, you are correct, openroadsmedia.org is our nonprofit, but I want to direct people's focus to our current work, and which is under that nonprofit, but to get people to understand what we're doing at the Podcast Academy and the podcast itself, go to latitudeadjustmentpod.com and just look for Podcast Academy. The thing that we're working on right now is to train displaced peoples to be podcasters so that they can take control of the narrative about their lives and also get the truth out in context where there are, you know, restrictions and censorship on free speech or other oppressive measures being brought to bear against them. So that's what we're working on now, and we're fundraising for it. So not to sound too shameless here, but we need some support if we want to grow this idea and continue it. And that's absolutely our plan. So listen to our show. Please subscribe to Latitude Adjustment Podcast, and please support the Latitude Adjustment Podcast Academy. And thank you very much for having me on.
Yes, please, not only subscribe. Oh, absolutely. Thank you for being here. And yes, listeners, please not only subscribe, but also support. Send them a few dollars to help keeping this project going. And Eric, thanks again. Please keep in touch.
Thank you both.
Thanks,
have
Eric.
A great rest of the day.
All right. I appreciate it. Thanks.
Special thanks to our guest, Eric Maddox. Thanks to our producer, Noah Existe, and editor, Joe Tompoco. Our music was written and performed by Nadia Importate. Thank you so much for listening. If this podcast brightened your day in any way, please subscribe and leave us a comment. If you have a suggestion for a guest or simply have suggestions on how we can improve our show, please send us an email to betterplaceprojectpodcast@gmail.com. Look for small ways to be kind to others this week, and that will help make the world a better place.
Make the world a better place. Make the world a better place. Make the world.